This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about postnatal depression in fathers as well as mothers, plus parenting in general when dealing with mental illness. So before we get into the episode, I've got a few stats. First off, from the National Childbirth Trust, they found 73% of new fathers in Britain worry about their partner's mental health, and 38% worry about their own mental health. So Annie, thoughts on those initially?
Yeah, no, I'm really loving how we're finally talking about mental health for fathers and postnatal depression in men. I'm all for equality. I'm a big old feminist. I think it's super important to talk about men as well as women when we're talking about postnatal depression, because it does happen. And I'm really glad that we're providing a diverse voice and representing everyone, not just half of society.
As we touch on in the episode, what can frequently go wrong with the current NHS approach is that the father can be experiencing postnatal depression and that can then trigger it in the mother, whereas actually if there was more parity in the treatment, it may never actually get to that stage of both parents being affected.
That's so interesting that it can influence the father first instead of the mother. I know that if I personally became a mother myself, I would my mental health is already wrecked. Like, I can't imagine what it'd be like if you added childbirth and pregnancy and raising a child into that as well. Like, as we speak, I'm signed off work and I'm relatively comfortable, no children. I'm one of those double income, no kids kind of yuppies. So I find it super interesting how, well, I really admire women who don't suffer with any kind of postnatal depression, because it's such a life-changing and physically and emotionally and spiritually traumatic event to go through. So I'm kind of in awe or a bit confused by these women. Like, who are these women and where are they? Like, I'm impressed that they exist in the first place. But it's nice to know that all services are thinking about cutting off a problem at like the stem, if you like, and trying to get to that point instead of just treating symptoms, which I think our health service has done for far too long.
Right. No, that's a really good point. And in particular, I'm so glad to be having this conversation because of this expectation that persists that having a child is the most wonderful time in your life. It's a bit like when we talked about mental health around the festive period. There's this mentality that that's the most wonderful time of the year, but actually for many people it's not. And so if you're one of the people in either scenario who does struggle or does experience mental illness, then there can be this pressure to keep quiet about it, because we can equate it as there must be something wrong with us. Parenting is meant to be one of the most fulfilling things in your life, but if you're experiencing postnatal depression, you can struggle to even have initially the emotional connection to the baby that you would imagine and you would expect, and that can be incredibly jarring. And when I've had conversations like this in the past, that really comes through, this feeling of I thought I was doing something wrong, I thought it must just be me and that other people don't go through this, because it's not talked about enough. And so in particular, I'm so glad to be talking about this on the Time to Talk Day. So today, when this episode comes out, the 7th Yay. Of February, is the same day as an initiative by Time to Change to get people talking more about mental health. And that's every type of mental health, because they believe in and understand the power of sharing your lived experience to combat stigma. So this is our little way of contributing to that. Not only is postnatal depression, I think, underreported and underspoke about, but particularly talking about it affecting all genders is a really timely discussion that I hope many of our listeners will bring to their day to continue these conversations on Time to Talk Day. So another stat we'll jump into is from the NSPCC. And that is that over 2 million children are estimated to be living with a parent who has a common mental health disorder.
Oh, damn, you sprung a statistic on me and now I haven't had time to look up what population of what 2 million people is.
Okay, I've looked it up for you, so do we want to edit this out?
Wow, and yes, please.
I've become, maybe we'll leave this ridiculousness in, I've become part of the conspiracy. Okay. Right, so I found out that over 2 million children represents the entire all ages population for Birmingham, Liverpool and Sheffield.
All put together or each?
All put together.
Whoa.
So you need those three cities to equal 2 million.
Shit a brick.
So
shit a literal brick.
The important point here, less so the cities, is the staggering amount of children this affects. Of course, we're talking in the episode all about the parents and how it's so important to support both parents. But actually, for every parent that's going through this, there's a child that's also experiencing it from the flip side. So yeah. This one was a really important one to me to highlight how many people this affects.
This is why I was so thrilled when we had Shanley Lewis come mm-hmm. back on the podcast, because we don't ever really consider how often these conditions affect families and close friends as well, and the people around us. And also, as a child of somebody with a mental health condition, I'm really grateful that that's being taken into account, the fact that adults with mental illness are fairly likely to be parents. And how does that affect their, not saying their ability to parent, but how does that affect their children and how they learn to cope? I think I learned quite a lot of harmful and not very productive or unhealthy coping mechanisms growing up, because that was all I was really exposed to. I had one parent living with a mental illness and the other parent pretending that their partner wasn't living with mental illness. So yeah, good old denial.
Childhood, great fun. It's interesting you should say that, because in the beginning of the interview with Mark, we actually do talk about his background and the community he's from, and how he was able to see now in hindsight how toxic coping mechanisms were passed down to different generations, and he's actively trying not to do the same with his own son. He's really trying to break that cycle. So it's a really interesting point, and I'm so glad you've brought it up.
Thank you very much. This mute thing is great, but also an absolute curse. It's a blessing and a curse.
Okay, so this is our attempt to speak over each other less, listeners, so I hope you appreciate it. It's not making our job any easier. We'll get into the episode shortly with Mark Williams, amongst loads of great campaigning and speaking around the country about mental health. He also is the publisher of Daddy Blues, which is a book published by Trigger Press. You can find the book, if you're interested, via the Trigger Press website or anywhere good books are sold. So we'll get into the episode with Mark Williams shortly. It is an incredibly moving episode, but please note we do talk quite a bit about suicide. So that's just something to bear in mind when going into this. It is at times quite an emotional interview. We'll get into that shortly, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Mark Williams, international campaigner, author and keynote speaker on the importance of fathers' mental health.
Could you start off by talking us through where you first became aware of mental illness, when you were maybe growing up or as a young person?
Nobody ever talked about mental health growing up. I didn't know anything about it, to be honest with you. My parents never talked about it. In the mining community, was, you know, as a case, if you had a problem, we'd just go down to the pub, you know, have mm-hmm. a drink. That's the case it was, you know, a totally different way of thinking.
With that, you didn't have the context of knowing what mental illness was. It wasn't talked about with you growing up, yet you got into support work and working in mental illness. How did that happen?
Basically, I was in sales, so I was self-employed. And slowly, I was starting to get into the voluntary sector. I had no purpose after that, you know, mm-hmm. but it really happened, really, in 2008. Mm-hmm. I was already like a voluntary youth worker right. at the youth club that helped me as a child. I didn't know at the time, obviously I had ADHD, so it, that was a place that really helped me is focus on sport. And yeah, it was a big impact in our community, but it was, yeah, I think 2010, 11, that's when I was really starting to get into mental health then. Mm-hmm. Set up a support group called Fathers Reaching Out.
I see. And we'll come back to that, but in terms of your experience, you were aware then growing up that there was a lot of suicide in your area, but you were aware that it also wasn't being talked about. Is that right?
I know, looking back now in school, I had a lot of moods up and down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very affected from school, obviously. Imagine, you know, I'd have a, couldn't keep still, you'd have a clip across a year, go and clean the cupboards. You know, I was told I was thick and stupid by teachers. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of low self-esteem came from school, unfortunately. Obviously, as I, you know, I didn't know I had dyslexia or ADHD. It was never really talked about. Nothing was talked about like that. It was a case of you just get on with it, and that's all I've done, you know. But my coping skill was drinking, you know. I started drinking, well, the first episode of drinking was 10, you know. Mm. But then 13, 14, 15, that's what we did. We just used to hang around bus stops and drink. But it was a youth club that really helped me, really supported me. And I went on to be a British champion, you know, under 16s. It was football. So luckily, sport really helped me get into really serious trouble, like, as well. Mm-hmm. And I had really good parents, you know, really good parents, still got good parents. But I was just, like, so impulsive, you know, I'd be doing mad, crazy things looking back. Yeah, I struggled for years, you know, low self-esteem from school, mm-hmm. mostly.
It's something that I think can be so common, turning to drink. And I feel like, particularly with men, it's hard to get away, because even with you finding sport and finding an outlet in that, well, drinking is such a part of football culture as well.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Well, the mining community, like you said, you work hard, play hard. You know, that's what my father did, and his father. You know, they're all miners. I'm a first generation not go underground. So, yeah, it was a case of looking at my father drinking, you know, and, you know, that vice versa. So if you had a problem, yeah, it'd be a case of let's go to the pub, let's have a drink, you know. We never talk about, yeah. My mother was a mental health nurse training. I found out that she had dyslexia. She didn't go on to do her nursing. So, yeah, there's a lot of things looking back in my mother's side. ADHD, Asperger's, perhaps, dyslexia. And I know about the genetic side of it, obviously. But it's only when you look back and working in the field now, I think, oh, yeah, you can see how things looks now in the my own family. And my mother's starting to talk about more like now as well. So It's all good.
That's really interesting. My parents both believe they have dyslexia. Mm. And yet, you know, with them growing up in Ireland, it wasn't something there was any support for.
No.
My grandfather on my mum's side probably had it as well, but he was in the time of having a dunce hat put on his head.
Yeah.
And So I'm so glad that these things are moving forward, but it is interesting when you look back and you start to notice these kind of patterns. It certainly, for me, makes me feel very glad I'm in the time we're in now.
Yeah. It's honestly totally different school. And my school didn't have a really good reputation anyway, you know. It was getting the corner, head in the corner. So I used to laugh it off, class clown. So, yeah, you know, but even now when I was working in the field of mental health, when you've got all these academics and you're going in the world, the doctor I work with now, you know, she's given me the confidence 7 years ago now and say, look, Mark, you know all this knowledge. I take in information different to other people. And, yeah, I'm like an encyclopedia when it comes to father's mental health, because the dads have opened up to me because of my personal experience as well and families. And I think working as a speaker, I've learned off professionals because I learn differently.
Yeah, I'm the same with my dyslexia. But also, it's actually a really convenient way of thinking and processing information for reducing stigma as well. Because there's campaigns like the Time to Change campaign, which this episode is actually being launched on their Time to Talk Day, which is every year trying to encourage people with lived experience to have these conversations.
Yeah.
Because it's very difficult to remain ignorant to mental health ins and outs when you hear people's real life stories. It's difficult not to relate to that. And That's why podcasts like this resonate, why campaigns like theirs does. It's interesting how we can have these setbacks, but we can turn them into skills when we find the right calling in our life.
Absolutely. Okay, so looking back, I think, oh my gosh, I can see you. Why that, you know, having the diagnosis, why everything, it all interlinks, a lot of stuff makes sense, you know. And I put the coping skills in place. I know if I'm overwhelmed with stuff, you know, I know my coping skills now. And yeah, it's been a bit of a journey, but I'm happy because now my son, who's 14, he's more likely to open up to me if he is struggling as well, you know. So, and other people in the valley have opened up. They can't believe I went through the depression and obviously the suicidal thoughts and stuff, because I'm always a happy-go-lucky person. Oh, you know, you're always smiling, always laughing, but that was a mask, you know. Depression is the biggest liar. It makes it the biggest liar too sometimes, certainly for me, you know.
Yeah, well, no one wins in it because it lies to you and tells you that you're worthless and you can't do anything. But then also you feel the need to lie to others and pretend the opposite, that you're fine.
And protect my wife, you know, because I didn't want my wife knowing how I was feeling because I didn't want to impact on her mental health as well.
Mm-hmm.
My wife works in mental health now as well. She's an advocate. We've totally changed our careers. We've got far less money, but we are more happier now because we've got more purpose in our lives, which is far better.
Well, it's interesting there what you mentioned of like the community you grow up in and trying to actually change this cycle, trying to pass on better tools to your son, because it's about breaking that cycle. It's tough. I strongly believe nobody does it by accident.
No.
You have to consciously see the problem and work on it in yourself and others.
Definitely. You're right. You're right. And it's one of the toughest, you know, in the Valley community. I know they don't mind me saying it's very much a man-up culture, you know. Mm. Come on, just get on with it. Well, I know now the quicker the help, the quicker recovery, you know. We need to have these conversations, and that's why I'm always happy to do podcasts and stuff. Definitely.
Yeah. And I'm interested just personally in that kind of community. To what extent do you feel like it could be partly a reaction to that kind of work, that, you know, they have limited options historically, there were limited job routes,
definitely.
And so they kind of had to just put up and just get on with it.
I was destined to go underground. Like, you know, I went for the miners' strike. You know, I've seen my father struggling, you know, having the food parcels coming in as an 11-year-old child. Seeing all this stress financially it can have on you. And I think that did impact me later on when my wife had post-depression. I had to give up work myself to look after her, you know. You start worrying all. But it's a sort of place that my father, like I said, it was go to work, down to pub, provide for family. It was no talk of university. Nobody ever sat me down and said you had an option to go to university. None of that, you know. So I'm glad things have changed now for my son, certainly. But no, I love my community. You know, it's some of the most friendliest people you can imagine. I would say are, but I think it's made me realise that when you look back, all these small little traumas has happened. We think of trauma as just one big thing. No, it can be little small little time bombs, and eventually that, if you don't deal with them, it just explodes, and that's what happened to me years later.
Right, absolutely. It's so tough the way you describe it with these guys in particular, that their life and their kind of centre is the home, and how do I provide for my family?
Yeah.
And then when you get something like the miners' strike, then that's ripped away, and suddenly these guys who have had such pride in their community are struggling to make ends meet and feed their families.
Oh, I don't think our community's ever really recovered from it, I'll be honest, because obviously the job losses, and then people weren't working, they were going into other shops and working together, talking together, offloading together, when men talk better side by side, I believe, you know, in the work I'm doing. So when you're digging coal and offloading, they didn't have that anymore. So the things they were coping with was drinking, you know, and there was a lot of depression and drugs. It caused a lot of people, relationships were ending, you know, miners were unemployed. A lot of stresses during that time. And I seen it. We witnessed it growing up, you know, as a child as well. So, yeah, massive. So
yeah, and that's why it's so clear how easy it is for that trauma to be passed on.
Definitely.
Because if you're a child growing up in that, you see the struggle.
Yeah.
And you see as well the way you described it, it really sounds so isolating. That, you know, you're used to going to work and that's your routine. And then there's all these families that are at home. They don't have this work bring them together.
Yeah, I know.
There's that physical separation as well.
Definitely. I've seen honest blokes, you know, stealing coal just to, you know, feed the family, you know. That's how bad it was. Luckily for me, my family, we didn't have it as bad as some families because it was only myself, you know.
Mm.
But other families are 3, 4, 5 children, like, you know. So it's made me stronger as a person as well, all these little things, you know, and made me appreciate things a lot more than... Everything happens for a reason as well, yeah, it's good.
And so with that context in mind then, we'll fast forward a little bit to a big pivotal moment in your life, which was having your son, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so we planned, me and Michelle got married, and then pregnancy was fine. 22 hours labour, I remember the doctors come rushing in, and instantly I looked at their faces and knew it was something wrong. And it was the first time I ever had a panic attack. Never had a panic attack like that ever before. And I felt really embarrassed because all the attention was on me. Well, she'd been on my wife. I was thinking all these horror stories, he's going to faint. But it wasn't until you go into emergency C-section and obviously, you know, things happen in the labour ward. Even now, you know, when I talk about it too much, I can feel the anxiety. Which, as you know, PTSD is an anxiety disorder either witness in or experience a life-threatening event, you know. So there's nothing worse than seeing your loved ones, your mother in the labour ward and thinking they're going to die, like. And
and that situation is so stressful as it is.
Yeah.
Without then the additional layer of you going through a panic attack, not knowing what that is, and you're just trying to fight to look after her, and you're struggling to keep yourself together.
You know, it was just all about, you know, and I even thought of me going into a labour ward now, you know, which luckily we only got one child. I've had the operation, can't have any more children. You know, the thought of me going in, a lot of fathers speak to going to a labour ward, even a smell can trigger off, as you know, PTSD. I never want to go into a labour ward again. That's only my experience. So my son was born, and then Ethan, my wife, it was something wrong with my wife. Straight away, I could see she went, you know, after 3 days in hospital. My wife went home. Yeah, she was really, you can tell instantly the health is came around, and then the words postnatal depression. I was like, postnatal depression, what's it all about, you know?
And at that point, what sort of signs had you seen? You knew she was different.
Yeah, she just, you know, her eyes, you know, clinging to me, won't let me go, and scared. She was really scared. Right. You know, it wasn't the fact that she couldn't bond, it wasn't the bond, and didn't want to try, it wasn't that. It just didn't think she was good enough, you know. So she was, like, in bed, and obviously, and, yeah, she was just scared, like, you know, really scared. And even now, you know, so it was like a fog, you know, looking back, thinking of it. And instantly it was picked up straight away by the health visitor. And Michelle's quite open. We were open now that, as the months went on, you know, she didn't want to be here. You know, the crisis team was involved. And when you witness your wife did what she did, you think you're going to lose it again. I had to give her work for 6 months. I was self-employed. There was no money coming in then, mortgage to pay. Thinking again, go back, you know, am I going to provide my family? Couldn't tell my wife how I was starting to feel as well, because I didn't want to impact on her mental health.
Mm.
And initially, I'll be honest with you, I didn't have a bond initially. I didn't have this overwhelming feeling of love for my son initially because I'm just relieved he was alive. But I think that bond and attachment grew my son because I was home for 6 months. So when my wife was unwell in bed, I was with my son. And it's such a lonely time, I think, during that time for me because I couldn't tell anyone how I was feeling. I couldn't tell anyone, my friends, couldn't tell my family and such. Because you worry about social services being involved, you know, and my son was safe, like, but I think when it came to crisis point, our families were involved. We had a circle, and we were lucky. A lot of families haven't got that family support. But still, I didn't tell anyone how I was feeling. I remember my mother-in-law see me crying or so, you know, in a chair. Around a 3 or 4 month mark, I was starting to get suicidal thoughts myself. I remember punching a sofa, bust my hand. Anger, never been so angry in that time, in the postnatal period, the first 12 months. I remember when I did manage to go out, I was drinking, trying to start fights with bouncers, not because I had a chance of beating them up or anything. But it was, you know, when somebody's hitting it, I never thought of self-harm. You know, when somebody's punching, you know. And that's what I was looking for. Like, but I didn't know I'd self-managed for years. And then my wife had severe postnatal depression. And eventually I was depressed in the postnatal period, which is why I campaigned. So it was a lot going on in a short space of time, like, you know.
Right, I can just tell hearing it just how overwhelming that was, and it feels that as much as you had the family support, you were just trying to look after your wife, your son, and then you put yourself third. It's very natural to think like that. We had an episode recently about being a family carer, and it sort of reminded me of that, how when you have someone close to you that's really going through a bad patch of mental illness, it can be difficult to prioritise yourself because you think, well, you know, they're worse than me. I need to be there for them. I can deal with this later.
Yeah.
And when you're from that background of, like, drinking to deal with problems, or, you know, maybe even, like, fighting as a way to let that aggression out, then it makes sense that you've just kind of bottled that up.
Yeah, you're right. Totally right. And, you know, at that time, you know, when I was in kickboxing, so I was physically fit. But it wasn't until years later, so when my wife did recover, and I don't know, I lost my grandfather with dementia, and my mother was diagnosed with cancer within weeks of each other, thinking I was going to lose my mother. Still hadn't dealt with everything else, all these little things, all these big things to me, what happened. affect my job again. And then I started isolating myself even worse this time. Mm. I was driving the car, go up to the mountains, you know, and pretend to go work, and then sleep in the car, hiding it from my family, because obviously I was getting paranoid. My job at the time was, trying to get out to sales at the time. I was trying to get into mental health, voluntary work and different things. And 2011, really, I was just going down this mad, slippery slope, and like, you know, and I just still didn't get the help. Kept fighting on. I'd be good. I'd be better tomorrow.
And how old was your son at this point?
Yeah, my son was, about 5, 6 he was.
Okay.
For those 5 years, I was up and down, changing jobs, boredom, a lot of, I know looking back, the ADHD had a lot to do with it as well, but I think it was, I hadn't dealt with everything else, you know, and thinking I was going to lose my mother as well, again, which I love my mother, you know, mm. my family, and just escalated then, really bad at drinking again, looking back, it's just, I was a totally different person, but my suicidal thoughts are getting worse and worse now. I don't want to go back. I had all suicidal thoughts around about the 4 months mark, 6 months. But 2011 it was a game changer for me. I think I was just going to a point where in what I know now, my body just shut down, really. And I just stuck in a car. I couldn't get out of the car. And I think luckily it did happen to me, because I think, I'll be honest, I've been honest, especially the last couple of years, if it wasn't my son, I don't think I possibly might not be here now today, you know, because it got to the point I didn't care if my wife left me, Michelle, as long as I was alive for my son, that's all my goal was, really. Mm-hmm. So I didn't care about my job, didn't care anything. I didn't worry what people thought of me anymore. And that's what stopped me as well. I used to worry that if I went to GP, it'd be on my record, so I wouldn't get a job going back, providing mm-hmm. my family again. And I just thought, right, sort it. And yeah, I just shut down. Lucky that phone. And this charity basically said, look, if we can get out of the car, we'll try and get you to the GP. And yeah, I went to the GP. And then...
May I ask what charity you called?
Yeah, Mental Health Matters Wales. And my wife works from now. I've done work in the past from. So there's a lady on the phone, and went to the GP. I was put on medication. I was in community mental health services, where eventually I was diagnosed with, it took me 3 years to get a diagnosis of ADHD. People said I had bipolar, all sorts of things. But it was funny, because I think my reason why I recovered so quick, it was around about 6 to 8 weeks. So I was in a gym one day, and so I was on medication. I was getting back in the gym slowly, getting back into work. I was working in a secure unit in Cardiff, waiting for that job. And I told this guy in the gym, I said, can I have all the weights? And he said, yeah. So I got to go to NHS Prams. I said, oh, what's NHS Prams? He said, my wife's got post-impression. I said, no way. I said, my wife had post-impression too. Instantly, side by side, I told him more things in 5 minutes than I told my best mates, anyone I related to what he went through. And Brian's quite happy to say, because we've done stuff together. He witnessed his father die from suicide 20 years ago. It kept him back in his head. But then his wife went on to have severe post-depression, his second wife. And he was on his third child, he was a lot older than me. And yeah, Brian had a breakdown. He was in services and himself, because he was just looking after his wife. And I thought, hold on. So I said, Brian, did anyone ask you how you was feeling? And he said, no. We just said, okay. So I set up a father's reaching out support group.
Can we just pause there? Yeah. Because that's such an important point of how often we can see what others need, even if we don't see it in ourselves. Like you went straight to, but how were you coping?
Yeah.
Whereas it doesn't sound like you were asking yourself the same question. Mm. You were really just trying to focus on, how can I look after everyone else? I can't let them know, you know, if I'm not working enough, I'm going to pretend to be at work. And you're just, you're coming up with all these strategies to keep it bottled in.
Yeah.
You obviously knew that there was, I think by the sounds of it, the whole time you knew that that wasn't right, because you speak to another guy that's been in that situation and your mind is straight away, well, how are you coping?
Yeah, you're
Who
right.
Who's looking after you?
It's funny you should say that, because only recently somebody else said that to me. It's as uncanny as you said that. But it was, I think what it was, when I spoke to Brian, I just felt really good. I felt, oh my gosh, somebody else gets it. Because I didn't know anyone who would, gone through it as a father during that time, and that was a game changer for me. I just felt when I set up the support group, which is only to support fathers with their partners with post depression, that's all it was. I found that I was struggling myself. I found he was. I found other fathers who were suffering from what we now know as post depression, bit of trauma, anxiety, which is higher. And sometimes it was only dad was suffering, which was impacting on the mother's mental health. And then relationships were ending. You know, dads couldn't bond with their children like mums. And yeah, it just opened up. You know, it just went crazy in 2011-12. And I think I was lucky enough to meet Dr. Jane Hanley, and she trained me up in perinatal mental health, you know, which I'm still working with Jane now. And I realised that I didn't know dad suffered from postnatal depression either, you know. I thought he had to give birth to have postnatal depression, but you know, but the hormone changes, but his hormone changes in dad's, testosterone changes during this time. But all I would describe it is, if there was no pregnancy or baby, that man or woman wouldn't be depressed in the postnatal period. Yeah. So the only time I had really deep depression was during the postnatal period, but I still struggled on, as you know. And that's the difference, you know. We all got low moods, everything, but depression is a totally different ballgame, innit, I think. So, yeah, it just went from there. You know, I started to be nominated for the Pride Written Awards and all that stuff, and the media, and, yeah, it just went really quick because I don't think nobody was really talking about that time, like.
In a way, the way you describe it, it sounds like a far larger version of the conversation you had with Brian, that you met that one person that had been through something similar, and it just opened up your mind to, I'm not alone. I can speak about this. My feelings are valid. And it sounds like you actually created a platform that just did that, but on a far bigger level. You sort of replicated and put that out for thousands of people to experience. And that's so powerful.
And it's myth that men don't talk. You put them in a safe place, and you know, and somebody with a lived experience, I think that was a key. You know, they were just telling me stuff on it. Unfortunately, the children die sometimes, you know, babies die, loads of things I've heard over the years. And that's where I got the education from. Even now today, I'm still learning off dads today, like, as well as from the academics as well, you know.
Right, absolutely. It's so powerful sharing those stories. Nobody's experience is going to be the same, but yet the experience of parenting is so universally stressful that a lot of the stories I hear of postnatal depression, it almost sounds like, of course you went through that. You had like a traumatic birth, or you lost a child, or you had twins and you weren't expecting twins. It could be any of these things that are just a level of stress you weren't expecting or weren't equipped to deal with. And that's never going to just be limited to one parent.
Yeah, of course, lack of sleep, you know, in loads of factors, as we know, you know. Same-sex couples, you can remember, adoptive parents. You know, it's depression in the postnatal period is the first 12 months, you know.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can describe it. And like you said, mums and dads, they got a previous history of anxiety, depression or traumas before they became parents. There's loads of factors why parents get postnatal depression.
Yeah. And it links back to a little bit something we talked about earlier, the like social isolation of things like being out of work. And how that can really cut us off from the support systems, because as much as you can have family support, not everyone has that. But for the most part, that child is the responsibility of its parents or parent. Yeah. If you combine that with it also being a period where you're generally at home more with the child, one or both of you is off work, it then seems so clear to me how this can spiral.
Yeah.
And how it can get on top of you, because this looking after this child and being in the home and being around all these emotions is your whole existence. Absolutely. Temporarily.
You're right. Well, what I will say as well is that my wife's depression came back the second time, because now she was looking after me in our short space of time as well. Right. And crisis team were involved again, like, you know, in 2012. So that's the importance of supporting both parents at the same time. My wife fully recovered, and then the counselling, and now she works in mental health, and now as well, you know. So I think it has far better outcomes when both parents are supported at the right time, because not just for themselves, but obviously the development of the child as well. Unfortunately, there's so many relationships are breaking down. You know, the father's, his behaviour's changed during this time as well. It does look different than mum's, so it'd be more drinking and more anger. An extreme case, and unfortunately there's been violence where there was no violence before as well, you know. So if dad is behaving differently during the antenatal period or during the postnatal period, we can ask the question, why is he avoiding rather than judge him as well? Because sometimes it could be depression.
Yeah, absolutely. It's perfectly natural for people to have periods of being overwhelmed and whatever coping mechanisms you had before the child are likely to resurface. That's the tools that you've got, for absolutely, better or for worse.
So you can imagine like a father with bipolar schizophrenia, just managing that, the baby comes along and lacks sleep structure. You know, some dads who use gym and then they're totally isolated, they can't go to the gym anymore. You know, I have dads who've got eating disorders. You know, it goes on and on.
And I want to bring in something we mentioned off air as well about the hormone changes, because for a long time, part of the justification for postnatal depression only affecting the mums was that, oh, they're the ones that go through the hormonal changes. No, but actually, that's not the case.
No.
You mentioned there that the testosterone goes down in the dads, quite simply from an evolutionary point of view, so that they're less likely to harm the baby, because you're suddenly got this thing that's keeping you up all night crying. Yeah. You could see how angry that could make somebody.
Yeah.
And so it's this hormonal change to try and reduce those levels, make you more passive.
Absolutely. Well, it's only recently had a father I spoke to, you know, getting treated for depression at this time. He had testosterone injection and everything. And that is research, you know, it's all there now. If people have a Google, you know, testosterone, you know, that impacts. It's only now the research is starting to come through now as well. Right. You know, 1 in 10 dads suffer from postnatal depression. Anxiety is 70% in new dads, higher, and those papers as high as 25% as well. NCT did a report I was involved with in 2015. It said that 38% of dads are concerned about their own mental health, and 73% of dads are concerned about their partner's mental health. Up to 50% of dads...
I actually have that statistic on my list. That's so great.
50% of dads will actually have depression looking after their partner with postnatal depression.
Even when I see the statistics and how shocking they can be, I still feel like they can be underrepresented, because the nature of having a child, it brings your focus very much inwards. Mm. You're then focused on that child and how do I raise them. You're not focused on, oh, let me just let know for their figures condition too.
We don't know how big it is, see? We don't know how big it is. That's the problem.
It's crazy how far the understanding has to go, but I'm so glad that it's getting there, because so often there is this unfortunate mentality of, we should be able to handle this on our own.
Mm.
That parenting is perfectly natural. We should be able to figure it out within the family. And I think that's a big factor on why it's underreported, because people don't want to admit to it. It's supposedly this natural thing that everyone can do, and that's just not true.
You're right. And then, like I said, I was 30 years of age, you know, you've got to think of young dads, you know, dads who unexpectedly being parents, you know, they've got these dreams going to university, all of a sudden a baby comes along. More stay-at-home dads now. There's more single dads than ever before. You know, fatherhood has totally changed now as well. Social media, as we know, you know, put all our fancy photos on and we've gone on holidays, when some dads I know are struggling, you know, with food banks. So we got to think of it as, you know, fatherhood has totally changed than when my father was a father and his father was a father as well, you know. The pressures are totally different now today than they were when my son was born 14 years ago.
I think it's just difficult to raise a child in the current political, social, economic climate, full stop.
But it's the best thing that ever happened to me, fatherhood. I just want to say as well. I don't want to be scared of this. Like you said, you know, that did happen to us. We didn't have any more children after that. Looking back, I'm glad I've gone through the experience. As hard as it is, I won't go back there, certainly not. And I know my wife wouldn't either. But we, you know, we both work in mental health now. Our life's a lot far better than ours, so.
Yeah, it's great to hear how much insight it's giving you, because there's often that dip. Your life seems okay and, you know, everything's going smoothly. And then you have this dip of, like, your mental illness starts to come into the forefront, but you're hiding from it. I think no matter how good you are with dealing with the stigma, everyone has some variation of that experience where they're coming to terms with it. And then you have to go back up to a place where you're more aware. And actually, as difficult as it can be, you learn so much. But one of the toughest things about this condition in particular is that arc is so short.
Mm.
We're talking about a year, potentially less, where you can go into the expectation of having a child as it's going to be the cherry on top of my life, it's starting a family, it's just what we want. And then within a few months, that can be completely shattered, and it can actually be one of the toughest experiences in your life?
Oh, the loneliest as well. Honestly, I was so, looking back, I was so lonely during that time as well, because I didn't have my wife who was very, I could bounce off as well. So she was so ill, you know, obviously. And so it was a lonely time looking back. And more you think about that time. I personally think my bond and attachment with my son grew during that 6 months. I was home. I was more co-parent. I was really involved, you know, because, you know, unfortunately, sometimes my wife was so ill. So I think there's research in Scandinavia that about, you know, the being home, you know, share parenting, and how important that is as well. Because I initially didn't, like I said, I didn't initially get that bond or attachment, you know, bond with my son. I didn't feel this overwhelming love that I was expecting. You know, I didn't, I'll be honest, you know.
Yeah.
But I grew, definitely.
I'm really glad to get to talk to you about this and shed light on this subject. We're coming near the end of our time now, but I'm really keen to finish up with one of the incredibly positive things you're doing now. Could you talk us through that?
Yeah. So, obviously, written a book called Daddy Blues, which was ghostwritten by Trigger Press. I got another book coming up with Dr. Jane Hanley next year, an academic book with Routledge, which is great. Doing public speaking, I've been Australia, New Zealand, America, all over UK. Founded International Father's Mental Health Day, which is always a day after Father's Day as well, because every dad is happy on a Monday. And I think with a new long-term plan with the NHS, which is a big game changer, where they have special support for dads now if the mother is unwell, we're posting perinatal mental health. But my argument is sometimes it's only dad who is suffering. We need to ask all parents, you know, not just... But yeah, no, everything's great, I'll be honest with you. And I still manage my mental health as well. You know, I don't think I'm not depressed like I was or anywhere near, like in 2011. Got to keep it on top of it as well. So I'm still learning, like...
And, yeah, but I can tell... how much it's changed your life, and it's really giving you this emotional vigor for parenting out of the hardest of circumstances.
And if one person of the podcast won't get the help, you know, I know the old thing, that's what it's all about, there, you know. It's I'm trying to inspire other people to do what I'm doing as well, you know. So
because you're doing a lot, and it's in particular, I'm so delighted to see the work you've been doing, being really a pioneer and trying to get that parity of support for men and women going through parenting. And I was really delighted to hear you in Parliament speaking about it as well.
Oh, no, thanks. Thanks, boy. Honestly, like I said, it's other countries now looking in now as well, which is really exciting as well. They're looking at what we're doing in England. I think it's, next couple of years, we're going to see massive changes for better for all parents as well.
That's great. That's a really great place to finish then. So if anyone wants to find out more about you or follow you online, where should they?
Yeah, just have a little Google, Mark Williams, Father's Mental Health, or International Father's Mental Health Day. Be involved on Twitter, Mark Williams, FMH. Just have a look, have a little Google on there.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for sharing with us today.
No, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.